you know, burden on your heart. And but I wanted, you know, I was very pleased coming up here to realize that I knew you were renting a church. Pastor had told me, but he never told me what church it was. In other words, denomination, the African Methodist Episcopal. Now, you got on your lobby, as you're going through there, you'll see a picture of the minister and his wife. That's Richard Allen, the Reverend Richard Allen. He's the founder of the African Methodist Episcopal. And you ought to do a little history on him. Suffice to say, he lived in the 18th century up in the New England region. He was converted to the Methodist faith and became a staunch believer in the Methodist concept, you know, of holiness and righteousness and godliness that Wesley preached. But to make a, you know, long story short, I'll tell you what, it's a fascinating story of the Reverend Richard Allen. He's an American hero. In my opinion, he should be someone that we should all, at least in terms of his principle, we don't worship men, I know that. I'm not suggesting in any way, but the Reverend Richard Allen, in terms of his godliness and his belief, listen, let me tell you what, we could all learn a lesson. I was telling some sisters, if you go on Google books, you know, the right, punch up the Reverend Richard Allen, and he wrote a short little autobiography of his life. I think you can download it for free, and you can't get better than that. And but if you go online and punch up the Reverend Richard Allen's name, I think about a year or two ago, it was the anniversary of him establishing this church, and they put a little documentary together. So, but the Reverend Richard Allen, I'm going to tell you what, I'm happy today. Because he's been one of my heroes ever since I just found out about the man. Well, look, let's commence in our study this morning. Before I begin, though, I want to just ask that you'll bow your head with me for a word of prayer. Father in heaven, we thank you once again for the privilege of coming together that we can meditate on your holy word. I pray, dear God, that you'll grace us with your presence and help us to remember that the word of the Lord is to be read intelligently. Now, dear God, I pray you enlighten our minds. Bless us. In Jesus' name, amen. Now, the topic this morning is the principle of repeat and enlarge. And this, to me, is one of the most... I remember when I first studied this principle or came across it, I tell you, it was fascinating. I studied this thing over and over again. It was just so thrilling to me when I learned the concept. obviously, over the years, the more you learn a particular issue, or in this case, it's a principle or a law, you begin to fine-tune the concept in your mind as you begin to... you know, as you begin to articulate at least within your mind in the concept. But look, let's look at first at 2 Timothy. Let's go over with me, please. We're going to look at a text here in 2 Timothy that I think is very important in terms of the concept of what I'm sharing here. 2 Timothy chapter 2, if you look with me here, verse 15. And somebody needs to keep me on time, please. 2 Timothy 2:15. Notice what it says, study to show thyself approved unto God, a workman that needeth not to be ashamed. Underscore this next phrase, rightly dividing the word of truth. Now the implication of that means there's a right way, obviously there's a wrong way. Look, any time there's an error, and I don't want to deal with the motivation in which someone arrives at that error. That can be very complicated. And finally, in the final analysis, really, sometimes you never really know why someone's in the error. But nonetheless, this issue stands true. Whenever there is error, it's because something, whatever that theory may have been, is taken out of context. In other words, the understanding of the principle has been rearranged from the actual setting in which God intended it to be employed. So all error stems from taking something out of context. You're not reading it right. Now again, why? In other words, what's the motivation? What prompts someone to not read it right? Well, I have no idea. Fundamentally, though, one of the biggest issues is pride. Pride of opinion. That's a terrible thing. Brought Lucifer down, and don't think it ain't, you know, can't bring us down. I mean, he was a perfect being, perfect. Perfect mind, perfect spirit, perfect attitude, yet he chose to cling to pride. Brought him down. So the Bible says there's a right way to study, there's a wrong way to study. Now, in terms of approaching a book of the Bible, depending on the nature of the book, that will determine some of the principles upon which you'll use to decipher what is it saying. For example, there's historical books, there's prophetic books, there's poetic books, there's various kinds. So certain principles will apply in every case. There's no doubt about that. Then other principles will apply only specific to that book itself because of the nature in which it is written. In other words, the structure or the framework in which the book is employed determines the nature of the principles you use. So it's critical that you understand that. Now, in this concept of repeat and enlarge, there is obviously a primary function that deals with, and we'll look at this in a second, in the nature of prophecy. Now, it does employ in concept in other aspects, and we'll look at that in a moment. So fundamentally, though, by the way, all I wanted to do is I just put bullet points for y'all just to make it real simple, and at least in concept and ideas. I didn't know how deep far to go, so I thought, well, it'd be best just to keep it simple, and we can go deeper if we need to. So the fundamental principle, you know, what is it? What are we talking about? When we look at this principle, and I say it's a principle, it's a law. Meaning, obviously what a principle is, a law, is, you know, you can't simply modify change depending on how you might feel towards a particular issue at that time. The principle never changes. In other words, when the principle is employed and you now are studying a particular issue relative to that principle, the principle guides you. You don't guide the principle. You understand? You don't sit there and say, well, and this is what you find, by the way, in a lot of places with a lot of people today, especially in regard to how they interpret prophecy. And I'm speaking within the realm of Adventism now. I mean, evangelical Christianity has abandoned the Protestant heritage of prophetic interpretation long ago. Sadly to say, we've got people within our own midst questioning the nature of the framework of prophecy within our own family. Now look, wait a minute here. I'm going to tell you something. I'm all for, and I believe wholeheartedly, we ought to be free thinkers. But, you know, Paul says, don't let your freedom be used as in, you know, as a means of for sin, you know, for going astray. In other words, look, dear friends, we need to be free thinkers. We need to be intelligent people, methodical in our way we work through a problem. This is called logic. You know, they teach you, used to teach logic in schools. Logic, how to be a logical thinker, you know, cause to effect. The educational system is so dumbed down now, even teachers can't logically think from cause to effect. That's how bad we've gotten. So, what is it? Well, it's a law, it's a principle to be applied when the particular issue that you're studying basically demands that. And it'll demand it based on the characteristics, the way it's being employed, the nature of the framework. Now, the repetition, and we're going to look at this when we get into prophecy in just a second. The repetition is to give emphasis to a particular truth. In other words, whenever there's a repeating, you see, it's a two-part, repeat and then enlarge. So obviously, something has to start it. You can't repeat when there's nothing there. So something starts it. It's the initial concept, or what I call the linchpin that holds it all together, the framework, or also the foundation. And then something repeats. In other words, comes around and repeats what's there. And it's to emphasize a particular truth, something that God wants. You're repeating something because He wants to emphasize something. Now, in the process of the repetition, there's an enlargement. In other words, God's not going to repeat the same thing and add nothing more. That's irrelevant. I mean, what? That's redundant. It makes no sense. God doesn't waste words. Now, you and I, we've wasted so much time in words, it's not funny. But God doesn't waste time in words. When God repeats something, it's to emphasize, and in the process of emphasis, He enlarges. There's a reason why. So this is really the concept. And of course, it will reveal in terms of the enlargement, expounded on a greater detail, meaning things that were prior. They were there, but not necessarily revealed in a finer way, in a deeper way. So the repetition expounds on those particular issues that God wants to emphasize, and in the process enlarges, gives you greater detail, greater emphasis on certain things. You understand? So there's a reason. And because, depending on the nature of how many times it's repeated, you'll see that principle keep getting larger and larger and larger. More detail, more detail, more detail. Now, there are three examples I want to share with you this morning on the principle, at least the concept. The first one here is the prophecies or visions that are repeated or in sometimes quoted by another writer. In other words, you'll have a prophet. They'll give a vision. You know, they'll have a vision. And maybe another prophet will quote that vision. And in the process, they'll enlarge it. Now, sometimes the process, and I'm going to show you, where you may not have another prophet or writer quoting you per se, God may give you a series of visions, each one building upon another, such as we're going to look in a moment, the book of Daniel. That's the classic example of this. The second point, in terms of the principle, you find the concept strewn throughout Hebrew poetry. It's all over Hebrew poetry. I'm going to give a few examples on it this morning. And by the way, Hebrew poetry, I remember when I was in college studying, I came across, I was studying literature, actually. We were English, and we were studying the poetry, the concept of poetry. And that's how I discovered about the nature of Hebrew poetry. And because I was stumbling across this, and at that time in 1986, Dr. Ford, the new theology, obviously was still really hot. I mean, the issue was still cooking. And one of the fundamental principles of which he challenged was the year-day principle. You know, Numbers 14:34, Ezekiel 4:6, and that's what we fundamentally use. And so I discovered, you know, my studies Hebrew poetry, and I began to inquire, I wonder if that principle applies with the year-day principle. So I started doing some research, and lo and behold, I got dozens of verses that teach the year-day principle based on the framework of understanding Hebrew poetry. There's scores. But this is fascinating study. I would encourage you to go deeper. And then the third thing is someone who quotes a previous writer, which is what I mentioned prior, or statement or prophecy. In other words, they may quote not everything, but a particular phrase. Paul does this. The just shall live by faith. You think that just popped into his head? He quoted somebody. You know what I'm saying? He quoted, and there's a reason. And we'll talk about that a little more when we go on. All right. Well, let's commence in the prophecies of Daniel. Now, you know that the book of Daniel is 12 chapters. 5 chapters are historical. 7 are prophetic. I mean, you can basically structure. I was a pastor. It don't matter to me. If we're going to ask questions, we're going to be nice, right? Kindness. That's all.
And also recognize that we have him for a limited amount of time. So.
Go ahead.
Just real quick, in the book of Zephaniah, are you talking about repeated and large? In Zephaniah, I believe in chapter 2 or chapter 1, it talks about the ritual will be destined and all this stuff, and that will be repeated in,
Well, dual application. There's a similar principle to that, but it depends on the nature of the framework. For example, whenever the principle of repeating a large applies, unlike Daniel, because God has given him one vision, and it becomes the framework, the foundation, then he gives him another that builds on that. It's a repetition. when you have in Zephaniah's case, and Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Isaiah, you can go down the list. Whenever their dual application is different than a repeat and a large, let me explain why. Fundamentally, at least to a certain degree. What you generally have in repeat and large, someone else quoting another writer. You understand? The framework tends to be seen in the concept where someone else is quoting, and then that quotation is enlarged, or that phrase or that concept. Dual application, like in Joel. Now, Joel itself, we know, based on what Peter said in the book of Acts, he repeats it, he enlarges. But we know for just from the framework of Joel itself, based on the identification or the characteristics written within that vision, we know it has more than two applications. Early rain and latter rain. In other words, the early rain of Peter's day and the latter rain for the last days. You see? So there's a historical context, Joel's day. Second application, dual, Peter's day. Third application, our day. You follow? You see what I mean? But that's found within the framework of the prophecy itself. In other words, just by studying Joel, you can figure that out. You don't need Peter to confirm that. So in Joel's case, you have a triple application plus the principle is repeat and enlarge only because Peter quoted it and enlarged. So let's look at the Daniel, the prophecies of Daniel. And let's look at this. Now I couldn't write everything down, so you have to forgive me. This is not a detailed, you know, study as we would like. But it suffice to the principle we want to study. If you look with me here, you see the seven chapters mentioned, or at least that I made reference to, that are prophetic by nature. Okay? Daniel 2, 7, 8, 9. Now, 8 and 9 should be together. They're the same in one. I've separated only because the nature in which it is employed, the 70 weeks. And, of course, remember at the end of Daniel 8, he fainted and God couldn't finish what he wanted to tell him. And then 10 through 12. So there you have the framework. Now, I want you to notice how it works. The horizontal, right? You're going across. This is where you have repetition. It's horizontal. The emphasis here has to do with a repetition of what went previous to, okay? And so the horizontal is repeat, and in the process of repeating, what is he going to do? He's going to enlarge. Now, the enlargement happens not horizontal, but vertically. Now, I want you to notice with me here, because the vertical concept has to do with time and detail. Okay? So if you look with me here, for example, let's work on the horizontal principle. And this is very easy. I mean, look, if you look here, Babylon, Daniel 7, he repeats it, Babylon. Now, when you get to 8, 9, 10 through 12, Babylon's no longer relevant. One, because Babylon's not ruling power anymore. It's not on the stage of history. Has nothing to do with the people of God. So what's the point of mentioning? It's irrelevant. So it falls off. There's also another reason why, because in the process of something being eliminated as it is going forward, greater detail comes as you go down further in the vertical concept. Now, so repeat, 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 repeat. This parallels. This puts everything in context. Okay? Now, this concept is important because when you look at this, Daniel 2 is the framework. It's the basis. Everything must be corresponding to Daniel 2. In other words, in order to get Daniel 7, 8, 9, 10 through 12 correct, you got to study Daniel 2 first. And you got to get that correct. And then you say, well, Brother Ray, come on, Daniel 2, that's child prophecy. I want to get deep in the Bible. Now, this is one of the problems I have with people today. You know, you want to go deep, but you don't even know the first things to go deep. That's like a child saying, I want to run, but you can't even crawl yet. You're so busy wanting to do something great when you can't even be able to do that which is little. And look, you got to come down to the concepts of understanding that first things are first. You say, well, you know, we've got to humble ourselves. Get back to Daniel 2. Get it right in your mind. And you say, well, Brother Ray, that's simple. Babylon, Medo Persia, Greece, pagan Rome, 10 toes, you know, the Western, you know, nations of Europe and so forth or whatever. And then, of course, the iron and the clay, you know, I put in their church and state because that's precisely what the servant Lord says it is. And then, of course, the stone cut out with our hands, of course, the second coming of the Lord Jesus Christ and so forth. Now, since repeating the large is employed in Daniel, and basically, I'll tell you something right now, in terms of the prophecy, that is the framework of the book of Daniel, repeating and large. That principle is fixated in that book. So if you don't get it down, as I say, Daniel is going to be rather difficult to comprehend, at least in terms of when you get down at the end. And see, by the way, when you look at the repetition themes, and that's what you want to be looking for, where is God taking me? You know, when you repeat something to someone, it's because you want to make sure two things happen. One, there's an emphasis placed on the importance of what you're saying, right? You're repeating it because you don't want them to what? Forget. So that's a critical thing. So here you have Daniel 2. This becomes the framework. Everything else must correspond. Now, that doesn't mean you don't get greater detail, but the greater detail in no way takes away or diminishes what previously went. So, and by the way, just as a little point on this, those who suggest today, you know, new light, new light. And I agree. We have, you know, God's going to give us new light, and he always has throughout the generations of time. He's always done that. There's no doubt about that. But new light in no way diminishes light that's previous or supplants the previous light. You're honest, it doesn't happen. Anytime you have something that's, quote, new light that takes the place of previous light and diminishes the previous position, or somehow veils over the significance of the previous vision or understanding, is not new light. It's a perversion of understanding. So let's go now, Daniel 2. So you Daniel 2, then you have Daniel 7. Here's the repeating, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece. Now in this particular case, now he enlarges. He enlarges because here you got four heads and four wings. Now you don't see that here in Daniel 2. What do you got? Thighs, belly and thighs of brass. That's all you got. So now you're repeating, but he's enlarging. Y'all see that? Because he wants you to focus. Now, but notice with me, and I'll talk about vertical going down, but just to notice with me here, you got Babylon, Medo, Persia, Greece, pagan Rome, and then, of course, the ten toes, and then ends it with the second coming. That's chronological order. The chronology is critical. But notice you're going down. As you're going down further, you see the enlargement. And it starts to broaden out. So repeat, enlarge. And then you keep repeating and repeating. Now, Daniel 7, though, he brings out the little horn. That's not there. At least in terms of a specific mention. You know, like a particular object being drawn to. But it is mentioned. You see, it is, if you understand Daniel 2 correctly. In other words, this is just confirming what's previously been there, you see. It's just helping you to understand. This helps clarify even more so what's being said, the church and the state in the last days. And, of course, obviously, as you know as well as I do, Daniel is the prophecy. Revelation is the unfolding of the prophecy. So all of this will come back. When you start Revelation 13, Revelation 17, Revelation 18, all of that's going to start to really magnify. So you see it here. And then, of course, Daniel 7, what does he introduce? He introduces the investigative judgment. Now, that's nowhere. In other words, you don't even see that even referenced. But the investigative judgment's clearly mentioned. And, of course, the ultimate, the second coming of Jesus. Now, in Daniel 8, again, there's a repetition, but Babylon's not mentioned, as I have referred to previously. And he keeps going. But in here, he enlarges a notable horn, then four horns, matching, of course, the four heads. But the notable horn representing specifically a power. In this case, obviously, it's Alexander the Great. But it's interesting, he uses the same symbol, little horn, as in Daniel 7, Daniel 8. But just because the same symbol is employed doesn't mean it's the same interpretation. Context in the way in which the symbol is employed determines the nature of the interpretation. So you have to look at the characteristics. You have to understand how the symbol is employed. This demands the right interpretation. So,
I've always understood that it's because of the 2300 days starting with Media Persia that
That's a very good point. What's two things? One, as I mentioned, it's no longer relevant. In other words, it's no longer, look, it's coming to an end. It's coming down. It's no longer on the centerpiece, and it's not the focal point, and you're right. Because when you get down, and by the way, it starts with Medo-Persian. It's very interesting you bring that up, because when it deals with the issue of the daily, and this is critical to know and understand. Remember, the daily, all the Hebrew word means continual. But it's always connected with the abomination that make it desolate. If you read on in Daniel 8, and that, of course, we know to be clearly the papacy. But look, if you study that in connection, you understand that the daily represents paganism. Paganism of what? Not just pagan Rome, the paganism of Medo-Persia, the paganism of Greece. It's a perpetual, it's ongoing. And of course, where in the world did Medo-Persia absorb some of its concepts? From Babylon. And so it's an ongoing, you understand? A continual paganism. And so you have it. It's a drop-off, it's continuation, and you're right. It'll come down as it spills over into the 2300 days, at least 70 weeks on this issue. So you're right, and it keeps going. But the little horn here, and I want you to notice here, the little horn, same symbol as Daniel 7, but in this case, because the context admits that it's pagan papal. One symbol, two powers. You say, well, how can that be? Well, this isn't anything unique or somehow strange. This is used by Paul. He used this. John the Revelator used the concept of taking something that had existed prior to, but that power absorbed itself into something else. That's why the daily is critical. Because the daily, in understanding pagan, papal, Roman, and the little horn, the daily basically is the framework to understand that concept, at least in the application of the little horn of Daniel 8. And because pagan Rome absorbed itself, or found itself being absorbed by papal Rome. So the one symbol represents two powers. For example, in 2 Thessalonians, where it says, now he who letteth will let only until he be taken out of the way. That word let, of course, old archaic English. It just means that hindering power. The person that Paul's referring to, and he actually says, now you know who I'm talking about. He writing to the Thessalonians, he says, you already know who I'm talking about. There's a reason why he doesn't mention the person's name or the power, because had it gone public and Caesar ever got his hand on that document, that letter, Christians would have been slaughtered right off the face of the earth. But that's who Paul was referring to. The hindering power that preventing the papal power, the Antichrist, from coming was Rome. Once it fell, then you can look for the coming of the Antichrist itself. I understand what
so
you mean.
The difference is word that's used in there.
Right. Well, that,
interesting.
That's fine.
What's your thoughts?
Well, unfortunately, we're not studying the daily today. We're repeating in large. So I'll talk to you later on that. Look, let me just say this to you. Look, you're seeing a repetition. You're seeing, but you see an enlargement. And the enlargement, as I mentioned, happens vertically. You're going down chronologically. Why is God emphasizing these things as you go further down? Because where do we live? Do we live in Babylon time period? No. Medo-Persia, Greece. We're living down here. The next thing is this. You see? That's what's happening. We're going down. We live here. We don't live up there. So by understanding this, you know what you're going to see by the time you get down to Daniel 11 and 12? Our day, today, in detail. So here you have that repetition. There's an enlargement. Again, Daniel 9, because it's a continuation. As you know, as I mentioned, Daniel fainted as he was beginning to see what the papacy was going to do. He saw how the horrendous things that was going to happen to God's people. He fainted. It was too emotional. It was too stressful. He just couldn't take it. Now imagine a prophet, a vision. He can't take it. You know that's got to be overwhelming, friends. So in Daniel 9, he picks up and he begins the process of the 2300 days, or at least the connecting of the starting point of the 2300 days, because there is no starting point in Daniel 8, only the length of time. And he tells you what happens at the end. But time prophecy means nothing without the cornerstone, the starting point. So Daniel 9 is the starting point and the 70 weeks, which is the first 490 years of the 2300 days, which leaves you obviously 1810 left. So there you've got your continuation. But by the time you get to Daniel 9, I mean, you are really getting into detail. I mean, it's detail. You're getting when the Messiah would come, the very year of his death, the very year of his baptism. It's all there in detail. So you can see that as you're going across horizontal, the repetition, vertically, it's gone now deeper, 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 broader, broader, magnifying, magnifying, magnifying. God's trying to tell you something. And by the time you get down to Daniel 10 through 12, which is the last, now you're going so deep into details. I mean, you know, starts off with the Medo-Persia. You got Greece and the four generals. Immediately. And then immediately, he doesn't waste any time. Few verses just on those things I just mentioned. And then immediately, king of the south versus the king of the north. I mean, it's a constant struggle between these two until the king of the north prevails. And then by the time he prevails, and of course, by the way, the king of the north, and I was time to get onto this. We know it to be corresponding with the little horn of Daniel 7, and of course, partly in regard to the little horn of Daniel 8. It's a papacy, and there's no doubt about it. But by the time you get down to verses 40 to 45 and spill over into Daniel 12 and the first couple of verses, I'm telling you, friends, you are the last days of this earth's history. Our day is there. But all of that is built on the framework. Now, when you get down to this period here, time of the end, 1798, which is starting point of verse 40, and it spills over all the way to Daniel 12, verse 1, which is the close of human probation, then, of course, obviously, second coming of Jesus and so forth. I mean, friends, you're down to iron and clay. So what is here in iron and clay, church and state, is really intensified here when you get to Daniel 12, Daniel 11, 40 to 45, Daniel 12. I mean, it's just intensified. It's last day events. So repeating happens horizontally, right? There's a paralleling. And the vertical, in terms of time, chronology, always heads down. In other words, there's a reason why the vertical concept, you're going down in chronological order, and the further you go down, the bigger it gets, the broader it becomes. Okay? Now look, we gotta move on because I know we're really slipping over time. So let's move on to a little Hebrew poetry, shall we? By the way, I got 30 minutes. Oh, we'll be alright. We'll be alright. So by the way, let me go back just a second on this. On Daniel, just for a second here. When you understand this principle, and this is to me, Daniel is the easiest way to learn it. In other words, don't try to drink too much water at one time. You know, one little glass will help you. It'll take you to the next level. All right? Start with this. This is easy. In terms of framework and understanding the concept, this is where you want to start. Really, I really recommend that. Now, once you understand that, then you can go into the book of Revelation. Because Revelation, though not structured as easy as this, I mean, Daniel, in terms of the prophecy, this is very easily formatted. The prophecies itself basically tell you that's how it works. But in Revelation, the principle still applies because there is a repeat and a large in the book of Revelation. Now, here's where I'm going to ask you some questions. Yes, sir. I'm going to get out of your way. Where do you think In the book of Revelation, you can find the principle of repeat and enlarge, where a prophecy is given. You know, obviously, you're not going to have another writer quoting it. It's the same writer. But God gives them another vision, repeating that previous vision and enlarging upon that one. Can you tell me? Just one example. Does anybody know? No, Pastor, you can't. You guys, you are out of it. So just... Well, seven churches, seven seals, seven trumpets, though, just because there's a repetition of the seven doesn't necessarily mean the prophecy is repeating itself. What you want to look for is where you have a prophecy that's given, and you find later on that fundamentally that same prophecy is repeated, but now it's brought in much deeper, much broader. Oh, see, does he know? He knows.
I'm not sure. I was just wondering.
No, sure.
I was just wondering about Revelation 18.
All right. Then look. Well, that's a good point. She brought up a very good point on Revelation chapter. I'll help. I mean, I'll carry the concept. You're right. In chapter Revelation 14, the second angel, verse 8, right? We know when you go to Revelation 18, at the repeating of that message. So you have a repeat, and he enlarges, right? Because it's a continuation of the concept. And that's very good. That's very nice. And that's even harder to figure out only because it's almost, obviously we understand that it's Adventist, but it's very minuscule. In other words, if you're not really paying attention, you're going to miss that one. So it's very good that you would bring that out. Very, very astute of you. So, but Daniel, Revelation 13, let me help you. Revelation 13. Okay, and then you go over to 17. At 17, he's building now. Obviously, he's not talking about the second beast in 17, though it's obviously involved. I mean, let's be honest about it. But the primary object is, remember, all the world wanders after the beast, not the second, the first. And it's the second that's making the world everybody go after the first beast. So, you know, so when you look at 17 is really a great magnification of 13. And so you do see that in Revelation. It's a very interesting way. But Revelation, in terms of the way it's structured prophetically, is different overall than Daniel. Okay, because Daniel, you have this one principle that applies to all the prophecies, this repeat and enlarge. That's not the case in the book of Revelation. It's very different.
Does it sometimes go back, like when you look at Revelation 12 and I think 6?
You're talking about the 1260?
Not 12.
Time and a half?
No, come on.
42 months?
No, you know when they start bringing down that the woman in Revelation 12, it talks about the woman and she gave birth to a child and was hiding in the wilderness, and then you go to Revelation chapter 5, it gives you a detail of time frames of, you know, the blood of the martyrs and the saints and all that stuff. So does it sometimes go back?
Well, you know, that's just slightly a little different. In terms of the principle, when you have a historical event that's occurred or mentioned, mm-hmm. and you might, there might be a time period mentioned in another prophecy that will cover that period, doesn't necessarily mean the prophet is making a specific reference to that particular event that covers that period of time. It all depends on the characteristics. What you have to do in the principle of repeating the large, like anything else in terms of fundamental principles, look for certain characteristics that draw your ultimate conclusion that it must be this principle that is referring to. It's just like adding things up, identifying more. For example, when we look at the Antichrist or the United States and the prophecy, we give characteristics. Isn't that right? And what are we doing? What's the purpose? Well, we want you to draw a conclusion based on the evidence. In other words, all of those identifying marks lead you somewhere, right? That's what you do. When you look at Daniel 2, for example, there are characteristics. And those characteristics lead you somewhere. It leads you to the principle of repeat and enlarge. There's no other way you can look at the framework of the prophecy. It's impossible. This is built on that. So let's move on now, but I want to go on and talk just slightly about some Hebrew poetry, just a little bit. The concept, though not prophetic in nature per se, though Hebrew poetry does cover prophecy. There's no doubt about that. But that's not the framework in which it's written. It's written in Hebrew poetry. The structure is Hebrew poetry. The subject matter can vary. So, don't look for the subject matter thinking that's the framework in which it's written. You got to look for the framework first. That's the critical thing that tells you how to interpret, not the subject matter. So, let's look at it. First of all, I want to recommend some reading. SDA Bible Commentary, Volume 3, pages 17 to 28. It's called The Poetry of the Bible. That'll really help you. I think it's nice, it's clean, it's precise. It'll take you to where you need to go further, and that's why I recommend other sources. And you say, well, where am I going to find other sources? Look, go on Google Books, punch up Hebrew poetry. And you're going to find old scholarly works. Now, some of them can be deep, I will admit. But that's all right. It's okay. Don't discard it. But still, nonetheless, Bible commentaries, Bible handbooks, these analytical books, books like that will help you to structure your understanding in regard to this. So go to Bible Commentary, Volume 3, page 17 to 28. That'll really give you what you need to at least understand how to go about it. Now, let's look at this. Hebrew poetry's chief peculiarity is a parallelism, or what is known as verse rhythm. It's also known as echo parallelism. Echo. When you at a cave or you somewhere and you yell out something like, whatever it is, hello. Notice when you do that, it repeats whatever you're saying, right? But what does it do? It enlarges. Now, the same principle applies with a pebble in a pond. Throw the pebble down. You have the initial splash, right? Then what happens? A ripple effect. Repeats it, but what happens? Keeps getting bigger and bigger. You enlarge. So it's known as echo parallelism. All right? That's one way you can describe, or as I say, verse rhythm. There's two forms of parallelism. Obviously, there's primary, which is really the predominant one. And then there's secondary, which is basically fundamentally the same framework of how it's used, but it goes deeper. And for example, in most cases, you'll have one line that is the initial line and then a follow-up line. Now, that's very easy, one line and then another line that follows up. It repeats and enlarges, okay? But in the secondary, you may have three, four, five. It all depends how many times he repeats it. You understand? There's a framework so it can go deeper. I ain't going to deal with secondary today. We don't have time. There are three kinds of primary forms of parallelism that is generally recognized. Three. These are the fundamental. In some cases I've read where there's four, but usually the fourth is dovetailing into the third. So I don't want to go that deep. But we'll just stick it with the three. The first is known as synonymous parallelism. And meaning what? The same thought is expressed or echoed by repeating it in the second line. So you got your first line, whatever that might be. Second line is going to repeat it and echo what is said there, meaning enlarge. And that's where, for example, you study the day-year or the year-day principle. Synonymous parallelism, I'm telling you, you'll find text after text after text. Be incredible. But let's look at an example. This is just, go to Psalm 19 with me. Psalm 19. Psalm 19. Look here with me. And let's look here, verse 8 and 9. And you'll see it here. This is the first line. Now, by the way, let me just say something. The way our Bibles are structured, written, formatted, I'm not talking about translation now, so everybody can just ease up. I'm not talking about translation. I'm talking about the way it is structured is absolutely incorrect. The way you're reading it right now in your Bible, you got a column, columns? Mm-hmm. That's wrong. Because it should be structured precisely as Hebrew poetry demands it be written. It's a poetic book. Remember, chapters and verses were put there by man. Good intentions, no doubt. Unfortunately, in the attempt to try to help simplify, they made it in some cases worse. Now let me show you how. For example, I'm going to read it as it is written. Okay, as it is structured, I should say, as it is structured. And you'll see what I mean when I read it, how it should be read correctly. The statutes of the Lord are right and rejoicing the heart. The commandments of the Lord are pure and lightening the eyes. In other words, it makes it bleed in as if it's just one. And that's not right. It should be paralleled out. Precisely, this is how it should be. First line should be, the statutes of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. Stop. That's a break. Now, instead of it having continued on, it should be broken right underneath it. Not beside it, underneath it. So the statutes of the Lord, what are they? The commandments of the Lord. Notice the statutes of the Lord are right. What are they? The commandments of the Lord are pure. Rejoice in the heart, enlighten the eyes. You all see that? And if it had been structured right, you'd have, boom, you'd have picked that thing up real quick. Now, you can buy parallel Bibles. And Cambridge just printed one recently. You talk to the pastor. He'll help you out. No, I didn't say now. I didn't say now. But you can talk to the pastor. And trust me, they have printed Bibles that do structure correctly. Okay? King James. So you got nothing to worry about. But you see, now look, what's the first line? What's the first line? Let's look at it here. The statutes of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. So you quickly know, just from the first line, the subject matter and the emphasis he wants to make. But notice now, the second line is going to repeat it and really make an emphasis or enlarge upon the concept. He says what? The commandment of the Lord is pure, enlightening the eyes. So you have the first line that initiates the subject matter, a repeating, and in the process of repeating, what is he doing? He enlarges. He enlarges. Synonymous parallelism to me it's the easiest form. It's one of the easiest, but it's exciting. I'll tell you honestly, when you look at the book of Job, because all your poetic books, Job, you know, Ecclesiastes, Proverbs, Psalms, Song of Solomon, yeah, those five. And by the way, those are the predominant books that are structured in Hebrew poetry. But you will find Hebrew poetry structured in various places throughout the Bible, even in New Testament. But that's a total different thing. But the point is, when you understand this, and then you start to read, and that's why I recommend get a paragraph Bible. Talk to the pastor, he'll help you. If you get a paragraph Bible, I tell you, as God is my witness, things will pop off the pages that you have never seen before. Let me ask you something. I love reading. I don't know how y'all are. Pastor and I, I do. I really enjoy it. People say, what do you do to relax? I like to go book hunting. And I'm a bookaholic, darling. I'm a bookaholic. God took me from alcohol and drugs to books. So I love to read. I enjoy it. I find it thrilling to my mind. But books are written a sentence. That's a complete thought. What's a paragraph? A series of sentences that relative to an overall thought that completes that paragraph. What's a chapter? A series of paragraphs relative to a subject that completes it in all those paragraphs. Isn't that right? And you keep carrying on. So how many? Then you have a book that's the theme of a comic, whatever it's on, a biography or whatever, right? And what is that? That's a series of chapters. And each chapter is a completion of a particular issue relative to the overall theme of the book, isn't that right? Until you finish out the book. Now, that's how a book should be read. But that's not how the Bible is structured. You know how it's structured? Just in sentences. Verse by verse by verse by verse by verse. That's sentences. But you see, the problem is this. Nobody would read a book. If I gave you a book, 300 pages, that's a little book. If I gave you a book 300 pages and it was just structured in sentences, no paragraphs, no chapters, just sentences, you'd go out of your mind. You say, I'm not going to read that. I can't. Where's he want to stop his thought at? It's structured wrong. The Bible is structured wrong. Paragraph Bibles. Now that's where you want to go. That's where you want to go. So you see let's go to verse 9. Look at this. The fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. There's your first line. That's your first line. Okay? So, the judgments of the Lord are true. Notice the fear of the Lord is clean. Corresponding with what? The judgments of the Lord are true. So the fear of the Lord is synonymous to the judgments of the Lord. Right? So it's clean, it's true. And then he says, and righteous altogether. So the fear of the Lord is clean, enduring forever. The judgments of the Lord are true, righteous altogether. There's your synonymous parallelism. Repeat, enlarge, magnify. And I'm going to tell you, I'm not kidding, you're going to see things in the Bible you've never seen before. You can say, wow, I hadn't noticed here. And by the way, when the author, like in this case, the Psalms or Job or whatever, when they wrote, or when the books were written, I should say, they were written in a style that was clearly understood by everyone who could read it at that time. You understand? They were educated, in other words, that way. It was educated in that way of thinking. All right? So, but we're not educated that way. We don't think in Hebrew. See, poetry today, we have a Western mind, so we think of rhyming, rhythm and rhyme. You know, Johnny ran up the hill. Then he fell, you know, then he took a spill. You know, that kind of stuff. Well, you know, that's the kind of way we rhyme. And you learn that in elementary school. But the Hebrews, Eastern culture, that's a no-no. They don't think that way. And this is about how they think, how they communicate. So if you can understand how they're thinking, how they communicate, how much more will you learn? So let's keep moving on. There's the second kind of parallelism is called anathetic or antithetical, where contrasting thoughts are expressed. You know, up and down, east, west, you know, black and white. In other words, you've got antithetical. It's the opposite extreme. In other words, now that I love this. This is really exciting. If you think synonymous parallelism is exciting, go to antithetical parallelism, because here you've got a thought, and then here comes another thought that parallels it but contrasts it. And what do you do when you have a double negative? When you do something grammar and it's a double negative, what are you doing? What's the purpose of a double negative? There you go. It's the positive. That's the point of a double negative. So what's he really trying to do here when he has something that's antithetical? What are you doing? You're contrasting. You know, this man is this, and I give certain characteristics. And I say, Bill's the other way, boom, 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 boom. What am I doing? I'm contrasting antithetically to emphasize. That. Now, this is really exciting. All right, so let's go to Judges 5. Go with me to Judges. Chapter 5, verse 31. Judges 5:31. 5:31. And again, by the way, the way it's read or the way it's structured is incorrect. And I'll explain what I mean, because the last phrase, and the land had rested 40 years, has nothing to do with the Hebrew poetry of the antithetical way in which it's written. That should be separated from the actual antithetical parallelism. But the way it's written, you'd think, oh, it's a part of it. No, that's no. I'm going to read it to you the way it should be. So, this is Judges 5:31. So let all thine enemies perish, O Lord. All right? So let all thy enemies perish, O Lord. That's the first line. But let them that love him be as the sun when it goeth forth in his might. Wicked, righteous, damnation, blessings, evil, good. Y'all with me? Do y'all see that? Emphasis. Antithetical, opposite extreme, and he parallels them, but you see the emphasis of the point. He's driving it home. This is a beautiful way to study, and I'm telling you, you are going to love it when you understand some of these concepts, how you can pull things out of Scripture. Because I'm telling you, it'll just pop out. It's just waiting to get out. So it's a beautiful thing, antithetical. Let's look at the third one. The third one is synthetic. Meaning the second line continues by way of enlargement and completes the thought of the first. In other words, you've got the first thought that comes out, right? It's synthetic, meaning it will enlarge itself but complete the thought. So it's critical And this is even more so when you understand the nature of synthetic parallelism, that you really understand how it should be framed in terms of when you're reading it. Because if it's not structured, of all the forms, this, if not structured right, will be the hardest to figure out. Because it's a completion of a thought as well as an enlargement. So let's look at an example, Proverbs 15:17. Let's look at an example, Proverbs 15:17. Proverbs 15:17. Let's look here real quick. Proverbs 15:17. Okay? Now, this is how it should be read. Okay? Better is a dinner of herbs where love is. That's your first line. Now, it's synthetic. What's it going to do? Enlarge and what? Complete. Enlarge and complete. Okay? Better is a dinner of herbs where love is than a stalled ox and hatred therewith. You understand what he's saying? I'd rather eat bitter herbs where peace and happiness exist than a banquet where everybody hates one another. Do you see what he's saying? You understand? That's the point he wants to make. Synthetic enlarges and completes. This is a beautiful, beautiful way to look and understand of what the Bible's saying. And it's like I say, it's just incredible, the meaning. So we got to move on though. Let me go on. What about somebody? This is the third way. This is the third example. What about somebody who quotes another writer? Now I made reference to this earlier on, but what about somebody who quotes a writer? Maybe a statement, maybe not the whole prophecy, but just a statement, a phrase. What about this? Does that apply? You better well believe it does, because what happens when someone quotes another writer? When you got a writer then quoting a previous writer, what happens? Well, there's a repeating of what? The message or the characteristics that previous writer gave. The enlarger makes an application of the message or characteristics and magnifies the interpretation. Now, this is what I really like about this. Now, let me give you some examples here. Now, I've just written a few of them. And by the way, 80 to 90%, I forgot the exact percentage, Pastor. I don't know if you know it or not, but I know it's 80 to 90%, somewhere within that framework. It's actually very high. Maybe in the upper 80s, lower 90s. It's that high. Of the New Testament is a direct or indirect quote from the Old Testament. That's what I'm talking about. But what you're getting is, if you can understand this, what you're getting is that in the process of quoting a previous writer, okay, he's going to quote the characteristics, the concepts and ideas, and then he applies it. But in the application, he gives you the context of interpretation. Now, what's interesting about this, you got to understand something. Because of the repeat and the large concept, okay, the previous statement where it's made always helps to framework how you interpret it when it's repeated. So that way you can understand a clearer way. For example, look here. I got it here I gave Acts, for example, Acts 2. I made references in Joel. I made it in Joel chapter 2, all right? Now, when Peter quotes Joel, if you don't know the book of Joel, and especially chapter 2 and those verses that are referenced there, then you really can't understand some of the concept and context in how and why he's using that. So it always demands that you go back whenever there's a quotation. It always demands that you go back. Now, take, for example, here Jude. Now, this is interesting. The book of Jude, all right, it's only one chapter. But the book of Jude was written approximately around, my memory's right, hope I don't get this wrong, I want to say around 70 A.D. And I know that, or maybe 60, no, because 2 Peter was written in 67, 66, 67. And I think, if my memory's right, Jude was written around 68, 69, somewhere around there, somewhere within that period. But look, Now, this is interesting. In this case, if you will study Jude, and you will find in 2 Peter chapter 2 that Jude basically took the second chapter of 2 Peter and simply rewrote it and filled in a few spaces. It's basically a verbatim quote of 2 Peter chapter 2. So he's repeating. And what does he do? If you read the book of Jude, you're going to see him enlarge, broadening out things. It's incredible. And this applies all the way across. Look, let's go over, for example, the Matthew real quick, because we only got a few moments left now. We got to go through this. Go to Matthew with me, chapter 10. Matthew chapter 10. And notice with me here, verses 34 to 36. Matthew 10, 34, 36. He said, "Think not that I am come to send peace on earth. I came not to send peace, but a sword. For I am come to set a man at variance against his father, and the daughter against his mother, and the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a man's foe shall be they of his own household." Now, he is quoting Micah 7, 5 through 6. Okay? He's quoting it. But if you go back to Micah 5 and 6, he says, "Trust ye not in a friend. Put ye not confidence in a guide. And keep the doors of thy mouth from her that lieth in thy bosom." Why? He said, "Because your worst enemy shall be they of your own household." What did Jesus do? Quoted it. He repeated it. And what did he do? He enlarged on it. And because, by the way, this is repeated in Luke as well. So you can see even how Luke records the historical event. But nonetheless, you see this is repeat, enlarge, repeat, enlarge, repeat, enlarge. And it's done through this throughout. For example, and we got to have to close up now. Look, Matthew 24, 36 to 39. How many remember what that says? "As it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be in the days of the coming of the Son of Man." Right? They're eating, drinking, and so forth. Right? Now listen to me. What's he quoting? What's he quoting? A historical event that occurred where? In Genesis 6 and 7. Isn't that right? He's quoting a historical event. But what does he quote? Does he quote the whole story? Quotes the characteristics. How does he do it? He repeats it. And what does he do? He makes application and enlarges. So you see the principle constantly being used throughout Scripture. The principle of repeating the large is one of the most fascinating principles throughout the Bible. And I tell you, if you can just master yourself, just get a little grip on it. Just get a grip on it. I'm telling you, you will never see the Bible the same. May God bless you and the Lord be with you is my prayer. Thank you very much.